Ho, brother, see you this dainty dish set to cook in the sun?
Aye, a dish so rare and fine, I deem it time I should sample it here in the gardens of the Swords and Scrolls podcast, where Rotating Rogues Gallery joins me in discussing comics and more in the genre of heroic fantasy. I am Jared Savitas, your guide in the realm of swords and sorcery. Now, this episode is super special. Joining me today in the Tavern of Tales to discuss a set of Red Sonja stories, which appeared as backups in the Conan comics, is this podcast's number one international fan, Dean Rowe. No, welcome, Dean, to the land of scrolls.
I'm not sure I can live up to that lead-in, Jared. You've done me a fair service. Well met.
You stumbled into the show when you were like searching for something, right? Like you were just
Thongor.
Okay.
It all started with Thongor.
I'm surprised that Thongor reeled in the people that when I get some feedback, I occasionally get a lot of Thongor feedback. And so it's funny to me that that guy is what reeled in some people to the podcast. But you then contacted me, messaged me, and we've been kind of talking back and forth. And you're one of the few that have gone out even and gotten the Thundar cartoons. And
oh yeah,
I'm very pleased and touched when people do that stuff because they listen to this little meager show of mine. And I was like, well, damn, Dean, you want to come on the show and talk a little, some comics? And
of course, said, for sure.
You said yes. So here we are. This is great.
How could I say no? I couldn't say no.
And you're in the future, man. And it blows my mind.
Yep. In the convex lands of Van Diemen's land. Yes.
I got to run down some standard questions for you, sir, if you're ready to get grilled by this stuff. So are you a comic book fan? Have you been a fan of comics for?
Yep. Yeah, for a very long time. I even worked in comic book shops when I was in university. So yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And it's funny because a little while ago, I felt personally attacked by a little bit of dialogue on your show. And
oh, no.
No, that's just in a joking way, but I was like, oop, that's me. Because you were talking about, I can't remember who it was, it might have been Jason Barrow, where you're talking about the 90s and like Image and that selection of artists around that era, like, you know, the rock star ones that were around. That was me. I was one of those fans. I was like, oh, no. I'm suitably less cool when it comes to comics than I thought I was.
I should watch my mouth, because I think any way someone can get into comics is a good thing, and I should not take away people's joy from what they you know, liked or feel nostalgia for or anything like that. So was there a particular character or anything that pulled you into comics?
The love affair of comics sort of started with sort of, I guess, IP as a kid. So, like, you know, I grew up in an era where, you know, there was heaps of Spider-Man. You had, you know, the Hulk TV show with Lou Ferrigno. You know, so like comic book characters were something that was kind of ingrained. And so that sort of era, that sort of, like, you know, probably mid to late 70s, you know, superhero stuff was, you know, just became part of my DNA. And a bit like, it was fun listening to episodes with your cousin, Michael.
Mike, yeah.
Mitchell. Yeah, Mike. Where you're talking about you'd swap comic books and stuff. And I had a similar kind of experience. I had an older cousin who had a big collection of comics. Sadly, a lot of them were federal reprints here in Australia for a while. Didn't bring in the colored American stuff. It was all like black and white reprints done by an Australian company. So,
okay.
But he had a big run of some stuff, and one of them was Nova. And I loved Nova. I don't know why. She was like Diamond Head. But so that was where the love affair for comics sort of began. But I was never, unlike yourself, I was never a big swords and sorcery kind of comic book fan.
Okay.
That was more, That was more literature. Like that was more
Okay.
books.
Sure.
So,
Yeah.
and it's funny because when I listened to the intro to the show long ago, and you explained that, you went to see Star Wars and you fell asleep. And I feel like you were kind of like, or maybe I am the faker or the anti-He-Man to your He-Man, because we have very similar points of interest. But I went and saw, I'm going to really date myself now. I went and saw Star Wars at the drive-in, in the back seat. And I'm pretty sure my mum, who was probably on a date, sort of thought he'll fall asleep. And I was just, oh my goodness, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Like, and so I totally nerded out. But I've always been, when it comes to movies, it's sci-fi. Like, because I don't think for a very, very long time that fantasy movies really lived up to sci-fi movies. Sci-fi movies always seemed, easy, like more immersive, easier to suspend your disbelief, and they just held up well. Whereas if you watch, say, a science fiction movie, you watch, say, A New Hope, right? Now, even if you can watch the non-digitally redone one, it still holds up pretty good. But you watch something like Beastmaster, and we can love it with all our heart, but it doesn't hold up great. Like, and there are a lot of movies of that era, especially direct to video, where it was just like, so I think for me, fantasy genre was books, and I love fantasy books. It's the main thing that I read, in sort of fiction. I don't read a lot of science fiction stuff, but it's mainly fantasy, and that's always been the case. But it's interesting that we have very similar points of sort of interest in what drew us in, like, sort of fighting fantasy books was one of the big ones for me. And that's why I particularly like the issue, oh, sorry, the episode with Jason Farrell where you talked about the Conan and Elric, because Michael Moorcock was the first thing that got me into fantasy.
Nice.
So that was the thing that got me into it. Yeah. So.
Moorcock is still kind of an area I have yet to really get into, beyond the comics I've read. I'm gonna have to reprimand that at some point, for
That's a
sure.
fantastic series. Fantastic series. You just have to be careful, when you're talking to people and, like regarding fantasy books and the like, saying I love Moorcock can get you in trouble. So
Ah! Yeah. Yes, sure. I love all that. Thank you. So we're going to be talking about Red Sonja, created by Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith. Now, do you have any history with Red Sonja at all, in any form?
With other redheads, but not this particular one. I think it was getting ready for the show. I was trying to think back to it. I think I've always kind of been aware of the character. I don't know whether it was, the guest appearances or, issues in Conan comics that I saw at the news agents or whatever, but I've kind of been familiar with the character. But I never read, I wouldn't have read unless it was like just, sort of having a bit of a flip through at the news agents before I got yelled at to put it back on the stand. But probably similar to two other guests on the show that have said they didn't really get into Conan or that sort of style of comic because they felt they were a bit too macho. I think I was probably a bit the same. So I've sort of hang my hat on that hook as well. But I think I was aware of the character, but obviously the first thing that really brought it to attention was the movie with, Bridget Nielsen and Arnie. But beyond that, yeah, like a little bit. I know I've sort of read and checked out bits and pieces here and there, but not. I wouldn't say that I was a huge fan, but listening to the bits and pieces on your show, I was like, they're like interesting character, like, basically the origin and who created it and. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I have yet to really do a heavy focus on her origin and such, but that's because I jump around the different tales here in the Tavern of Tales, So like I don't this here is like the first solo Sonya stories, actually, where she does not play second fiddle to a male character at all. I think she stands so well on her own without the shadow of Conan over her. So I'm very happy to talk about this. I love that Brigitte Nielsen movie for all of its faults.
You're talking about how the fantasy movies don't hold up. Like it's not great, but it is great.
I know that I remember watching it back in the day and I enjoyed it. Like I was like, wow, this is actually kind of probably better than I expected. I think I probably would have seen it on like in a rental VHS or something back in the day. But yeah, I remember being pleasantly surprised. I thought, yeah, it's actually pretty good. Like, yeah, so.
Red Sonja, so she first appeared in Conan the Barbarian number 23 from 1973. It's in the story called The Shadow of the Vulture. Her origin story is so unfortunate that it was told twice. It was even drawn and penciled twice. It's called The Day of the Sword. It first appeared in the Marvel magazine Kull and the Barbarians number 3 from 1975. It was written by Roy Thomas and Doug Mensch, and it was illustrated by Howard Chaykin. As I said, the same story was later redrawn by Dick Giordano and Terry Austin and published in the magazine Savage Sword of Conan, number 78, in July of 1982. The first one, which is drawn by Howard Chaykin, the original, it appears in a collection called The Further Adventures of Red Sonja, Volume 1. Alongside the two stories we are talking about today, that was released by Dynamite Comics, and it's all the like Red Sonja stuff from the Savage Sword magazines and such, the black and white magazines, and it was all recolored, modern coloring. So it's
Yeah,
a good way to get
we'll
those
get.
stories, but man, it's the coloring is,
Yeah, we can talk about the coloring. Yeah, it was yeah, it doesn't do them a lot of justice. I would have loved to have seen the Master of Shadows in black and white. Not
In
that I
black and white.
love black and white, but I would have loved to have seen, especially like John Buscema's like art, like I would love to have seen that in just straight black and white. It would have been great.
Dean, as the guest here, is there one you would want to lead off with? Talk about first?
Yeah, let's go. Oh, the episode's nice and short, so it's yeah,
Episode?
maybe kick with that. And I think that out of the two stories, it's the one with the less meat on the bones, I think.
I would agree with you. And chronologically, it did come out first. And it is actually the story why I am doing this episode specifically, because as promised in the Battle of the Barbarians season, which lasted a good chunk of 2025, this backup story episode appeared in Conan the Barbarian number 43 from 1974. I covered it on episode 26 of this show. And so I paired it with another short story, both of which are penciled by John Buscema. Now, episode is scripted by Roy Thomas, art by John Buscema. Dick Giordano does the inking. That's the exact same art team that is on the main story in that Conan, the Barbarian.
Yeah.
The colorist is Glynis Oliver Wien. And the letter is John Costanza. All right, I got a synopsis here, Dean.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Wrote it today.
I could have given you an Australianized one, but I'll let you go with it.
Here we go. Sonja rides through the Nemedian forest with a price on her head for killing the king of Paadisha in Hyrcania. This story plays out in the Savage Sword of Conan the Barbarian issue number 1 from 1974. She thinks she might meet up with Sigfall, whom she knows of old, and which she remembers wearing a distinct pure gold earring. Lost in thought, she and her horse blunder into a giant spider's web, becoming caught fast. She, but not her horse, escapes the spider's bite by becoming captured by two men who free her and take her before their master in a brooding castle hidden within the dense forest. While awaiting the master of the castle, she unknowingly partakes of roofied wine, which was placed there by Vincentius, who uses the spider to capture men and women to sacrifice to his dark gods. She awakens bound on a sacrificial stone slab next to a sturdy specimen of a man named Hunwolf, who is also bound to a stone slab. When their captor raises knife to sacrifice Sonya, she uses her legs to choke the man until he relents the sacrificial dagger to her. Cutting herself free, she says, "Hey, I'll just leave, but the demands of his gods are too great," and she is forced to kill him. As Sonya frees Hunwolf, the two men from before arrive, and once they are dealt with, Hunwolf presents a team-up for further gain of gold and treasure, much like the earring he took from a man he met and slayed. Sonya recognizes that piece of jewelry, which leads to her killing Hunwolf and reclaiming it for her fallen friend of old. She leaves the castle, turning her back on all that madness. Whew.
That's it.
Okay, Dean. You say there's not much meat on the bone. Let's hear it.
There's a bit. I mean, like you were good enough to send like images of the original as opposed to the recolor, and it's amazing the difference between the two. Yeah, like, you know, that old school nostalgia from that style of coloring, and I think a lot of that vibe is lost with the recoloring in the Dynamite collection. That first panel is great. Like, you know, the imagery that's in the writing, like, you know, the tiger stripes of shadow, you know, across Red Sonja on the horse, you know, sort of in a little bit of a, you know, sort of foresty kind of thing. One thing that I did notice straight up when I did a bit of a look back through, it's always about Darkwood with Red Sonja. So much about Darkwood, always in Darkwood Forest. And even with the most recent movie, which I have watched and actually enjoyed, it was all about the Darkwood too. So is that a Red Sonja trope? Or?
It must be. I guess I've really never clocked that because, you know, she's in the same sandbox as Conan. You know, they're here, they're there, they're moving through this place and through that place all the time that I don't ever really register so much where exactly things take place.
Because obviously the stuff that you sent and then having a bit of read through the omnibus which I picked up and stuff, but yeah, like the She Devil with a Sword and the Day of the Sword, both of them reference, they start off with Darkwood Forest, so
she can't get away from it.
And I was interested as well, if I'd be a bit nitpicky, the Dynamite collection references that this story was first published in the Savage Sword of Conan 48. But I don't
Yes,
think that's correct.
It is not correct at all, because I have that issue. Like, because I saw that and I was like, oh, did they do this in black and white? And they just recolored it for the comic. And I looked and I was like, oh, they got that totally wrong. It's the regular Conan 48, not Savage Sword.
Yep. That first page is great.
Yes, it is.
John can draw a horse too, which is good.
The thing that really stood out for me is I think that the coloring gets really great when she's in the castle. There's a lot of panels that use a lot of just like a lot of blue tones to kind of give a dim light to the feel of the panels. When she is captured, what's this goofball's name again?
Vincentius.
Yeah, that bald guy. He utilizes that spider to capture people. He sacrifices them to his dark gods because they demand it. But they don't just demand any old sacrifice, they demand a man and a woman. I love the part where, so yeah, they're monologuing. There's almost a full splash page within the story where he's gonna sacrifice her.
Yep.
It's almost a full splash, except for the top left of the page, there are two panels. One of the wizard saying, capturing you has made all the difference.
It's like Hammer Horror, like vampire look. He's got like that real sort of classic sort of, you know, vampire look. Yeah.
And the coloring is so great. But then she's like, well, don't spend all night slavering over yourself, old man. Slay me so my ears at least will know peace. Like, she's always spitting at these guys. That's the one thing I did appreciate about Roy Sonja in this story, is that she is very eye for an eye, just out to make a buck. But Roy likes to always make a point of the whole, she can't love a man.
She made the vow.
Yeah. He's always got to bring it up. And then he's always got to make a comment about her armor. or lack thereof.
Or lack
And
thereof, because she's rocking the chainmail bikini, which is that's questionable. That's not going to protect much. I mean, the important stuff, but not it's not going to protect you much.
not gonna protect you much, but look, man, she's been empowered by a goddess. She'll be all right. Kind of, she's got an edge.
A bit of an edge, yeah. I must admit that going through a lot of the sort of like this era of barbarian comics and stories, there's always a conversation on your show about like there's just a certain degree of perviness and rapiness, and I know it's an element of the era and probably of the style of story that's being written. But yeah, there's always like the comment that the villain makes when he's looking at Sonya on the table. Still, if I weren't so decrepit, that my very bones creak, I've a hunch the gods would go hungry tonight. Oh well. It's like creepy old man.
Yeah,
Creepy old man.
it's nasty business.
Creepy old man is a creepy old man with a giant spider. It's just not a good combo.
Yeah, and he roofies everybody. I do really love that panel of her when she is left alone in that room to w await her captor, and she grabs a flagon and pouring the wine. She's got such a big smile on her face, like, I'm just gonna drink this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's so great. Dick Giordano. I always stumble over the way that guy's last name. I think he does a really great ink job on this little story. It's very, his line is very light and clean, and he doesn't do the heavy lashes and eye that is going to be in the next story we talk about, which is kind of a Frank Thorne type of carryover. The styles are very different, even though it's Buscema's pencil between the two stories. Think I like the inking on this one better.
Yeah, the inking on this is really sweet. And the one thing that I really like about the depiction of Sonya through all of this is they nail her face. Like, just from researching for this particular show, like, it's very interesting. There are artists that just don't nail her face, or she can look decidedly average and weird in certain panels, whereas all the way through this, she's got the nice little cut in cheekbones. She's got a broader kind of face structure. She's got a little bit of a, like a strong jaw. The hairstyle is good. There's some very questionable 80s-esque Red Sonja hairstyles over certain stories. So yeah, but no, the inking is really sweet.
I'd have to say probably my favorite panel is, well, there's a few. There's the jug. There's the one where she takes back the earring and she's spinning it on her finger, as she says, "My code is simple, Hun Wolf, for a life, another life." But the panel below that, the very last panel of her walking out of the castle to the into the forest, I love that panel. It's she's going down kind of a stairwell that winds down from this castle. The stairwell is framed by some rock, and then there's just a wide forest spread out before. It's simple, cool panel for sure. I love it.
Yeah, I love the panel on the left of that. I really like too, where like Hun Wolf, like just his face, there sort of side profile laying there dead, and she's sort of walking out through the entrance, just a tiny bit of side bun there, which is always great. So yeah, but yeah, there's some really nice panels. Continuing with a theme that does pop up on the show from time to time, there were some panels that I did quite enjoy on page 30, smack bang in the middle. Hun Wolf says, "Wrong, Kushite," and he throws his sword.
Oh, yeah, he did.
He has obviously learnt the O'Shea Jackson art of swordplay.
He sure has. Man, it's funny to me how often that comes up. And then to just always tie it back to Doug on Douglas and
Yeah.
Dragons is so great.
The first couple of times in the show was just like, I throw my sword. And I was like, why is he throwing his sword? This makes no sense. And now from reading, like reading along with various bits and pieces from your show, I'm like, they do it all the time. It's just a trope. It happens.
Yes, it does. Probably for more than it should.
Well, yes, I'm not sure that it was that effective, but yeah.
Yeah, so Roy's story, think that it doesn't have as much character in it as much as the one we're going to be talking about next. It does its thing, but again, like when she's writing, she's thinking about this guy, Sigfall. She's like, oh, maybe I can, share a drink with that guy. And geez, if he's pretty handsome. And if I didn't have this vow, then maybe we could. That's a driving force for her to be traveling. Again, it's like it's a guy. It's a guy that's making her do a thing. And of course, that's what Roy's gonna write. And he's gonna write a
Whereas, yes,
creep that creeps on her, and he's gonna
she needs to be a strong, independent woman. That's what she needs to be.
Yeah. And even when Hunwolf gets freed by her and he's like, hey, let's team up. And then he's like, we can get treasures like this earring. And she's like, I recognize that. And so then he kind of like tries to make a play on her and maybe stab her in the back. Now he knows that she knows that he killed this guy for this earring. And a lot of story slammed into just a handful of pages. And I assume that this was probably supposed to be in Savage Sword if it follows. Well, maybe not, because okay, so the whole killing of the king of Padishah, so that started in her second appearance, right? In Conan the Barbarian, 24.
4, Song of Red Sonja?
Yep,
Yeah.
yeah, the Song of Red Sonja. So in that one, she is doing a job for the king of Padishah to get a trinket out of this tower. And that is it. Like, that is such a great issue, the Song of Red Sonja.
It
And
is. It's amazing. Yeah.
she then takes that trinket, and in the first issue of Savage Sword of Conan, she delivers it to the king, and things go sour. She kills him, and she's got to flee. And so it kind of makes me feel like maybe this was supposed to be a backup for Savage Sword sometime after that story.
And it does seem like in the Marvel bullpen back in the day, it was hey, there's a story missing or something. If you're missing in the post, we need a story, so there was
Yeah.
stuff floating around they could just load in.
You got any final thoughts for that one?
Well, one thing that's also aside from the Darkwood, another thing that's a bit of a concerning trope with Red Sonja's character is the way that she brings herself undone from her love of a good ale. Because the issue that you referred to before, like issue 24 with the Song of Red Sonja, same thing happens. She digs into a beer and it's drugged, and lo and behold, bang, she's out. So she, yeah, look, she's setting herself up for, for not being very safe in the Hyborian age.
Yeah. Yes. She definitely makes herself a target.
And the other one that always cracks me up with a lot of these stories, hey, we go into the forest, there's an abandoned castle, and there's a creepy old guy, or there's a creepy wizard, or whatever the case may be, and then, kill the wizard, kill the servants, and kill everybody else in the whole bloody place. And then, yeah, I'll just wander off into the wilderness. It's like, there's a castle. Like, just take it over. Become, Red Sonja of the Darkwood Castle, and, you could have your own, You can have your own, Castle Grayskull. Why not?
Exactly. And I'm sure there's treasures in that place, right? Like, this guy's been, but who knows what about his dark gods are going to get a little pissy about what just happened in there, but I don't know.
The dark gods. But then again, look, somebody like Red Sonja is gonna draw lots of ladies and lots of men. I mean, throw it out there in the Hyborian age. Who's up for a threesome? You're gonna have regular sacrifices. Could be some benefits there.
For sure.
But also, it's a bit formulaic, but it was fun. It was a really good fun little story. Creepy, weird kind of old dude, and yeah, and Hunwolf got what he deserved.
He sure did. Well, let us move on to our second story here. We are now jumping over to Savage Sword of Conan number 45 from 1979. The main story of that issue is The Gem in the Tower, which is an adaptation of an L. Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter story. Now, here's the thing. Before those guys teamed up, it was actually a story featuring, get ready for it, Dean.
I'm ready.
Thongor.
Oh, love a bit of Thongor.
So I think it's funny that L. Sprague de Camp said, Lynn, let's rework that Thongor story into a Conan story. And then Roy Thomas said, hey, let me take that story and make it into a comic. The backup story is what we are going to talk about tonight, though. It is titled Master of Shadows. This one is scripted by Christy Marks. Again, we have art by John Buscema and Tony DeZuniga. They are the same art team on the Gem in the Tower adaptation. So, again, same as the color comic, same art team, both stories. Amazing how that works out.
Yeah.
Dean, are you familiar with Christy Marks?
Look, I wasn't until we discussed doing this, and then I obviously, you know, went on a little bit of a look through to find out what her previous, you know, career highlights were. And it's varied and diverse, and, you know, she did a lot of stuff.
Yes, she sure did. And I'm a terrible comic book fan where I tend to not always pay attention to who's writing what. And so in researching Christy Marks, I was like, wait a minute, I'm an idiot, because I have always enjoyed her writing and I guess never really realized. So she was a writer for animation, including Conan the Adventure cartoon. She,
I was going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, she wrote various comics and role-playing games. She wrote what is considered volume 2 of Red Sonja in the 80s, which only lasted 2 issues. These Ooh. 2 issues were my intro to Red Sonja. I picked them up off the spinner rack. It is my that Red Sonja is actually my favorite look for Red Sonja, where she's wearing the blue with the yellow and black pirate sash around her waist. I've got to cover these issues someday, but those
he did the art on those.
Okay, so it is actually a mix. You have, I think, Dick Giordano and Ernie Colon do, I think, the first one. I think Esteban Moroto might do the second one. Those are my guesses without pulling them out and looking at them.
Yeah, no.
The first one has a beautiful John Buscema cover, and the second one, I can't remember who did, but the really interesting thing about those 2 issues, the Red Sonja has another redheaded girl with her that she believes is her sister. The story where she meets her and they get together was also written by Christy Marks, and it appeared in issue number 9 of a Marvel Super Special magazine from 1978. The story is called Day of Red Judgment, and it's the prequel to volume 2, those 2 issues of Red Sonja. In that, Christy Marks changes Red Sonja's origin story for the better, and she also gets Sonja out of the chainmail and puts her in the blue outfit. It's awesome. And these comics have never been reprinted. Dynamite has never reprinted them. I don't know why. They have not reprinted volume 3, which ran through the 80s and well as well, which was written mostly by Louise Simonson and a handful of others.
Yeah.
But that's where I fell in love with the character before I went back and got the chainmail bikini stuff.
Yep.
So the thing that got me when I figured out who Christy Marks was she wrote a series of comics for the Epic line at Marvel, called The Sisterhood of Steel in 1984, which was also a spinner rack buy for me that I really liked. It's a book that I'm kind of hesitating going back and revisiting because I don't want it to be bad. I want it to remain good in my head. But it's due for a reread. In 2003, for the New 52, Christy Marks rebooted the Sword of Sorcery comic at DC. That was the book that starred Fafford and the Grey Mouser in 1973, with stories button drawn by Howard Chaykin. But in the New 52, it featured the adventures of Amethyst, Princess of Gemworld. And it had backups featuring like Stalker and Beowulf, other old DC sword and sorcery characters. So she's like, man, if you ask me, Christy Marks, she's in. She's rad. I got it. Like, I'm mad I haven't praised her more before this.
Yeah, no, I was, yeah, just doing the research. Like, you know, she animation work she wrote for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which, like, you know, really sort of like piqued my interest. But then she wrote for Babylon 5, so the J. Michael Straczynski show, and you know, did a bit of Birds of Prey and Green Arrow at DC. But the one that I really peaked on, because obviously just recently listened to your episode with Jess about ElfQuest. She collaborated with Wendy Pinney on the Wolf Rider graphic novel.
Yeah, wild,
Yeah,
right?
and you love your ElfQuest, so.
I do. I do. Well, man, let's get into this here. Christy Marks writes a better Red Sonja story because she's not focused on the things that male writers are who write Red Sonja, who focus on her lack of armor, who focus on her vow. Like, none of that is in this story at all. Sonja is just like, just trying to be Sonja. She's not, she's just hanging out. We go into the synopsis for this one. Sonja relaxes in a public garden where she draws attention from unsavory men. Their unwanted advances lead to their humiliation and anger. These guys are part of the House of Shadows, a powerful family of assassins, and she is warned by its master to leave the city before the house seeks revenge. She ignores this and is attacked that night while sleeping at the inn. She kills the would-be assassin and disposes of the body out the window. Now it's on. The House of Shadows kills her stabled horse, and no longer is she welcome at any inn. The assassins attempt to poison her food, and thanks to a street cat, she learns of this attempt on her life. So she pays the House of Shadows a visit. Sonja wants payment for her horse and receives only threats from the brothers of the slain man. But the leader of the house pays her and says they're even and that she's gotta go. Yet now, no one will sell her a new horse, and with nowhere to stay, she finds an abandoned attic to sleep. Again, the brothers of the house seek her death, and one by one, she kills them in a battle that rages across nighted rooftop and dark moat. She again visits the master of the house to call a truce, but now it's gone too far, and she must pay. The master douses all light, so Sonja must face him in near total darkness. And with a well-placed yet blind dagger throw, Sonja kills the master. She returns to the gardens to enjoy its warmth and tranquility in peace. Oh boy.
It.
That's it.
And am I correct in understanding that this was originally slated to be like in an ongoing Red Sonja series that basically got cancelled before it even happened?
This one?
Yeah.
I didn't read anything like that. Did you find some research on that?
Just doing the old Googles, and it said I found a thing that said it was originally intended for an ongoing series that was cancelled before Master of Shadows could be used as a lead story. So I was like, yeah, okay, that's a
Okay, so let's see here. This was 1979.
79.
1979. When did She Devil with a Sword end? Because maybe it was supposed to be in that series before it got canceled. Yeah, number 15, the final issue is 1977. So it could have been
Right.
sitting in a drawer since
Intent.
then.
Yeah. It's interesting with the different writers, like, you know, with Roy, obviously, who did, you know, a big lion's share of a lot of the early stuff. But and then somebody like, you know, like Christy Marks, like there are similarities in the character. Like they it's not like where sometimes you'll get different writers and it's a totally different take and it's a totally different vibe. But you know, I think Roy does a pretty good job, but the constant reference to, as you said, the vow and the like, it's something that you probably don't need to revisit every issue, but that was the way Marvel did it. It like it is interesting that like her take and Roy's it's close.
Christie's story is so much more evenly paced for me too, where it's Sonya dealing with this House of Shadows, and that's it, and that's enough. And it's written as to where it's enough, as opposed to Roy, who's like, we got to have a spider, we got to have a creepy wizard, we got to have dark gods, we got to have a betrayal, we got to have revenge.
Yeah, there's nothing supernatural on this. It's all real world. It's all, yeah, kind of, you could imagine this is like, almost like a, an episode of like Game of Thrones or something.
Yes. Tony's inking is he uses very thick lines at times, to the point where it probably doesn't show as much in that recolored version I shared with you. It does kind of make a lot of the figures pop off the page almost, because they're so thickly outlined, which it's a little bit of a different inking style for him compared to, say, the main story in the same issue, where it doesn't have that. I also wonder if that is, again, any sort of tribute to Frank Thorne's ink and pencil work on the character, especially, like I mentioned, her really thick, luscious eyelashes. It's almost like she has these black, a constant black eye makeup all around her eyes throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, it's that line work. Yeah, on some of the smaller panels, it's I don't know, it doesn't work as well. But on that first page, that first image, that's just great. Like that's yeah, like the line that thick line work works. It does exactly what you said. It that image just pops right off the page. She's like just laying back luxuriously, like in the sun, like a purring cat. In the chainmail bikini.
Yeah, man. Hey, no tan lines. You gotta get your sun how you can. I like that
I'm
she wears a
pretty.
cloak the entire time too. It's such a simple little additive to her costume, but I like the cloak quite a bit.
Yeah, she's got a few sort of Wonder Woman-esque, armbands on the upper arms and stuff as well.
That's one thing I wanted to mention that I really appreciated about Christie's story is that she makes two points in it where Sonya's armor does what it's supposed to do. When the first assassin comes for her at night, Sonya, for some reason, is sleeping in her chainmail bikini. I mean, good for her, but
That's
you'd
got a
think it
pinch.
would be uncomfortable,
That's got a pinch.
but hey, maybe she passed out drunk again, Dean, you know.
Or she'd been rupeed again.
Yeah. But when he goes to stab her with the knife, her armband deflects it. And then when she is involved in the rooftop battle and chase, which is just a wonderful part of this story. I love the whole rooftop stuff between her and these three assassins. When one of them
Ninja
throws
star.
throwing stars at her, and one like goes ting off her shoulder plate. Christie makes a point to, call these deflections off. So like her armor does serve its purpose for what little of it there is.
It works.
Love that she's got to take these guys out one by one. It all happens like across rooftops and in the dark of night. She's jumping from roof to roof like a cat. There's a great panel of her like springing between buildings with the moonlight back behind her.
Yeah, that whole sort of like you said, the rooftop chase is great. And a lot of the other kind of dark, even though, as we've already mentioned, the recoloring probably doesn't do it a great deal of justice. But like there's a certain claustrophobia in a lot of those nighttime kind of panels, which works really, really well.
When I did read it in the collection, the colored version, the coloring really didn't bother me too much. I think what the coloring maybe did in that one is it kind of called out panels where they didn't spend a lot of time doing backgrounds. They colored like everything just like maybe a solid color. And there's a like a scene, even starting from scenes in the park, they don't draw any ground or anything like that. They just show the
Just
people
like
and like, the stone bench she's on. That stood out to me, but the rest of it I didn't think was colored too bad, aside from the narration boxes throughout the story are in reverse, and that didn't come out great in color. It did on the digital file, but like in the physical book, it's pretty muddy. So that's what's great about the black and white in the, well, there's tons of great about the black and white in the magazine, but that's one thing it's got going for it is it's easier to read.
Yep.
Is there any standout moments in this second one here for you?
Yeah, look, there's lots of really nice stuff. I mean, you've hit on some of it. But there's a couple of panels there where I wonder, like, basically, because sometimes various artists, kind of guest in or have to do stuff. There's a panel there on the top right where she's talking to the Master of Shadows just before she heads off to find an attic to sleep in, and that top panel of his face, it's very John Romita Jr. Like it's got that real vibe. I looked at that and went, wow, that's like very, very John Romita Jr. there, like the style of that face, and like the actual inking lines on the cheekbones and the style of the eye and the lip. I was like, wow. And yeah, some of the panels where she's running around, there's one there where it's onward beneath the full eye of the moon. She follows like a she panther hot on the scent of prey, and she's like jumping across roofs with the moon behind her, and it's just a really nice dynamic pose, and like in a very, very, just very subtle kind of artwork, but it works really, really nicely.
I see what you're saying about that Master of Shadows close up. Boy, you're right. It does look like a early Romita, his early X-Men work or something. It looks a
Yeah.
lot like it. And they
Oh,
use a
nice.
lot of like Zipitone and other graying effects for all these nighttime scenes. Sonya is pretty much always bright, though. Everything else will be kind of shadowed. She's got a little bit of shadow on her, but like her body, her cape, everything, her hair, it's always clean and white against everything else. Makes her really pop off
Yeah.
the environment. Keeps the focus on her moving through the
Yes.
shadows. It's cool.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the strengths of this story is it's quite a there's nothing supernatural. There's lots of parkour action. I mean, sort of makes you sort of think when it comes to the movies and stuff where at various stages like with the recent one and the previous where it's always about the supernatural stuff and that's a big part of that style of that era of story, but I think something like this translated onto the screen would have been great. Like imagine like another sort of parkour jumping across roofs and sort of throwing stars going everywhere and stuff. It would have made for a really, really great action sequence and a groovy little story.
Yeah, I agree.
All I was going to say is, and I had this weird thought because I always do this with books. When I'm reading books, I get an idea of a character, and you'll usually pin it to a similar actor. So, I think this guy seems like he might look like Harrison Ford, or this guy might look like such and such. And the Master of Shadows, I don't know what it is. I think maybe it was that first panel you just seen in the bottom sort of like right corner, and then later. I just couldn't have, I could imagine Ravishing Rick Rude from the WWF like actually playing this guy, which would make sense if it was a sequel to like the Bridget Nielsen movie, like because
Sure.
they probably have that kind of dollars to be able to get him in. I think he would have been perfect in this role.
Oh, that's so funny. That's great. I really do appreciate too that Christie bookended the story with the same scene. It ends where it started with Sonya just lazing in the garden. Taking it easy.
Sunning yourself.
Yeah.
You probably should have had a beer, but hey.
Yeah. Between our two Sonya stories we read here today, is there one that you liked more?
Yeah, the Master of Shadows is definitely the winner, without a doubt. It definitely a much got a better story. And I think, like as you said, Red Sonja's character is a bit more sort of fleshed out and realized in a better way. Not that Roy's a slouch in writing it, but yeah, basically I found that, that I could really sort of probably identify with the character a bit more. Got a bit more of an idea of her.
I agree with you. Master of Shadows is definitely the better of the two stories. When I first read it, I was like, oh, okay, that was good. But when I read it, just immediately reading it the second time, I was like, wow, this is really good. And I kind of expected to like episode better, to tell you the truth. I think because
Yeah.
I like the way it looked better. It's not the better story, no.
Yeah, the art, I think I probably enjoyed the art in the episode a bit more. But that said, I'm a massive like Big Dongli fan, not unlike yourself, I believe. So that bold line work and stuff, I can get with that. And with a lot of the art in Master of Shadows, it works, especially within the setting of, this Assassin's Guild, and it all happens at night. But it's, yeah, the artwork in episode is, the line work's really, really nice. And I think, nails Red Sonja's face and look a little bit better. But then you've got images like that front page, and various other spots through Master of Shadows, which are, great images of Red Sonja. So, yeah.
They both have very strong points to them. Dean, you told me when we were talking back and forth a little bit, you mentioned that part of you missed the whole quest board that we hang
I missed the quest
outside
board.
the Tavern of Tales. So,
If
hey.
you think about it, if you think about it, man, like I would never have discovered, I would never have discovered Thunder, like, basically without you guys sort of mentioning it and backwardsing and forwarding. But I think John Bunga mentioned, like, the Game Daddy himself mentioned an anime and I found that on Netflix, and I watched that. I was like, this is really good. And then you guys were talking about the Dragon Prince TV show on Netflix as well. You talk about that, and I was like, yeah. And there were various other bits, but some of it, like somebody was talking about Primal, and I was like, yeah, I've already watched that. That's cool. I love that cartoon. But yeah, I found a lot of stuff like Barbaric. That comic is just insanely good, and I
It
would have
is.
missed it. So I missed the questing board. I thought it was great. I loved that sort of, like, we're in a tavern, that shtick. It was good. So, and I think that with the guests that you have on, I think there's just so much stuff they could be like, hey, I'm digging this, and this is cool. And it would be, and people would be like, hey, I'm going to check that out.
I think that a lot of that is me being selfish, where I wanted to make sure to have consumable episodes that are compact with an hour, or maybe just a little over. And maybe I felt like that was starting to kind of drag us a little bit longer. But I would love for you to post a quest on our quest board here, though, Dean. So what do you got for us?
I'm going to be greedy. I've got two, but I'll do them very quickly.
Hey,
And
man, we have
first one,
like you said, it's been gone a long time. Coast board's empty. Let's fill it up.
well, I'm pretty sure, from what I've picked up, I'm pretty sure that John Bunga is a bit of a metal guy. So I sort of was, and things that I'm trying to, sort of, like, represent Australian culture here. I'm going to go with a musical quest as my first. And Australian kind of prog metal, prog rock, it's there's a certain level of our humor in it. It's a bit, we do it a bit weird, we do it a little bit of left of center. Anybody that's listened to, like, King Lizard and the Wizard Gizzard, or whatever the name is, I always confuse it. There's a weird humor in a lot of our metal and our rock. There is a band called Battle Snake,
Battle
and
Snake?
they are Battle Snake. And they do, there's the fantasy tropes in there, and there's, like, the Mad Max Road Warrior, there's a bit of the thunder, kind of like sorcery science. They are great. They're mad, but they are great. Gnome, who are really, really good, they do a similar kind of thing as well. And there is an amazing band, which not as much of a fantasy trope, but they're one of my favorites. They're called Dr. Colossus. And it's basically, what if the guys from Black Sabbath had gone on a solid drug trip, watched 10 episodes of The Simpsons, and then decided to do a concept album about The Simpsons? Dr. Colossus are insanely good and mad. So they're worth a listen. But yeah, Battle Snake, it's just, it has to be done. And the only other quest I'd post is one that I shared with you as well, which is one of my all-time favorite fantasy trilogies, which is the Winter of the World series by Michael Scottrohane, who sadly has passed away. But it's just a fantastic fantasy trilogy. There's a couple of other little side story books that he wrote later. But basically it predates things like Game of Thrones, but with a bit of a similar vibe, like Winter of the World and sort of Powers of the Ice. But it's like, what if Tolkien had focused more on Finnish mythology than European mythology? It's got a different slant, but it's just, the main protagonist and his little blacksmith buddy and sort of like a bit of a Frodo and Sam kind of thing going on. But it is its own thing, and the guy, the prose is just, it just flows off the page. I love the way he writes. And yeah, so it's one of those hidden gems. I never see any of those YouTube channels, 10 fantasy series, secret ones you should read. No one ever covers it. And it's just a great series.
Same with Battlesnake and Gnome. I've not heard any of these. I'm gonna have to.
No, with the convict islands, so there's all this stuff here that you're not aware of.
I gotta tell you, I am intimidated by Australia, Dean. Like, you guys have so much indigenous species, snakes and everything, that I'm just like, oh my God, how do these how do they live in how do they live with all this stuff around them?
Everything's poisonous. Yeah, everything's poisonous.
Everything's
Kangaroos,
poisonous.
drop bears. Like it's all poisonous. Here, where I'm from, we have a thing that we call a turbo chook, which is kind of like a weird cross between a chicken on crack and like the Roadrunner. So they're a native hen, they're a traditional animal. I think they were endangered for a while, but now they're everywhere. Like they've come back, but the turbo chooks. So there you go.
Is it like it's a yard bird? Like they're
No,
just.
it's like a wild kind of hen, but they move really fast and they don't go meet, but they're kind of like the Roadrunner. They go flat out, but native hen, the turbo chook to most Tasmanians. So. A real thing. Okay, like
it.
you guys have got bears and like I remember when I was on holiday in the States and I went to the Grand Canyon and a squirrel stole my sandwich and then somebody said don't try to take it back because they've got rabies and I'm like I thought Australia was supposed to have the bad stuff but I've never had a possum like steal my sandwich so.
Possums don't get rabies though. An opossum is the only North American marsupial, and you guys got marsupials all over the place.
We've got marsupials that lay eggs. We've got poisonous marsupials that lay eggs. Just,
Oh,
evolution gone wrong.
Man. Well, Dean, thank you for the quests, man. Seriously.
Worries at all.
Also, thank you for your time. I know you're on your day off and you're lacking rest, so I appreciate you taking the time to do this show with me and talk these comics.
Yeah, sorry, man. I've probably been with the lack of rest and the bit of inner fanboy still operating within me. I probably haven't been as effervescent as I probably would have been, but it's good. I feel it's an absolute honor to be on the show. Love the show. Great listen always.
Thank you for saying so. And hey, man, if we can always, you know me, I do repeat guests, so I
Yeah.
might reach out to you again and say, hey, man, what are we talking about next?
Yeah, I'll say, look, just let me get 8 hours sleep, and I guarantee. And I've never ever been quite so aware of not swearing. I don't think I've sworn once, which is kind of weird because I've tried to be quite proper because I don't want anybody to think that us Australians are uncouth and rude.
Typically, that's me, so I wouldn't, don't worry about that. You say what you want over here. There's no kids listening to this that I know of. My kid doesn't even
just.
listen
Conan, yeah.
to this.
And one last point as well is that remember I did buy the Conan Omnibus because of you.
Yeah, you did.
So at some stage, if there's a story in there and you want to be like, hey, that guy was like and that weird Australian guy, maybe we could drag him in for one of those. That would be cool.
There is one. I'm trying to think what it was, though. I'll look into it because I know that
Yeah.
there was something I thought we could chitter chat about. But thank you again, everybody. Thanks for listening and hanging out with us today as we talk some Red Sonja. As always, Support your local public libraries and support your local comic book shops. Dean, you got an LCS around you? You got a comic shop you hit?
No, there's no comic book shops in my surrounds. I've got to go all the way to Hobart, which is the other end of the state, and
Oh man.
yeah, they don't do new stuff. So I've got to, as I mentioned to you, basically with our chats, and sort of when I get to go to something like PAX, I'll usually go and buy up big. So.
I don't know how I could handle it nowadays without having a shop around to at least stick my face into once in a while.
Yep. Yeah, it's tough.
As always, when you are reaching for that bottle of wine, or you're going to sit down and have breakfast at the inn, make sure there's no poison in the food and make sure there's not any drugs in the
Yep, Red Sonja needs to learn that for sure.
wine. All right, man. Thanks, Dean.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.